Welcome to Tidbits of Research. My name's Sparanda Sandhu.
Manish Raghavan is an assistant professor in the Information Technology Department at MIT. When we were having our conversation, he had just graduated with his PhD from Cornell University. And in the meantime, he has also finished his postdoc at the Harvard Center for Research on Computation and Society. In this episode, we talk about his research on the societal impacts of algorithmic decision making, the importance of having a supportive and flexible PhD advisor, the fact that in a world with biases, like ours, it's impossible to build a model that hides those biases, and so much more. Manish Raghavan, welcome to Tidbits of Research. Your research interests are around the study of algorithms, and I want to delve deeply into this in a moment, but I first want to go back in time a little bit. Did you have a computer science course in middle school or high school? What was your first formal contact with computer science?
First formal contact must have been sometime in high school, either my junior or senior year of high school. My high school had whatever AP computer science course they offered. So I took that, didn't love it, but I didn't really know what else to do in college. So I decided to apply for computer science programs and ended up doing my undergrad in electrical engineering and computer science.
And you did that at Berkeley, right?
Yes.
Was the program kind of together from the start, or did you decide to kind of blend engineering and computer science together?
So it was in Berkeley, in the engineering school, if you want a computer science degree, it actually has to be a joint one between electrical engineering and computer science. But they really let you tailor it to your own interests as much as you want. So you take a few basic computer science courses, you take a few basic electrical engineering courses, and then after that, you can specialize however you want. And so I ended up mostly taking computer science and especially theory of computer science courses.
Do you remember when throughout your undergrad you started shifting more in that direction?
Probably a couple years in. I had done a couple of software engineering internships, and I was starting to realize that I was not that compelled by software engineering. It was fun for short amounts of time, but I felt like I wanted to understand things a little bit deeper and maybe spend a little bit more time going into the theory. So I ended up doing that for the last couple of years of college.
Mm-hmm. Navigating a bit towards research interests, I read that your research interests are the societal impacts of algorithmic decision-making. Mm-hmm. What are first some examples of algorithmic decision-making that someone should have in mind?
Algorithmic decision-making is everywhere and it's getting increasingly prevalent, possibly in places that people may not realize. So for instance, in many financial institutions, right, if you apply for a loan or if you apply for a credit card, your application is processed through some sort of algorithm. Someone has built a model somewhere that's going to evaluate you in some way and make a decision or contribute to a decision about whether you get credit or whether you get that credit card. Similarly, there are applications all over the public sector as well. For instance, in the criminal justice system, there are risk assessment algorithms that determine, basically seek to predict people's behavior in a way when they're in a pretrial hearing and a judge has to decide if they're going to get bail or not. So there's applications like that. There's applications like in child protective services, when a call comes in about a child or a household at risk, an algorithm may screen that and, you know, take into account past calls, that the family's other interactions with the government, and use that to determine some measure of risk. So people may be more or less comfortable with various applications here. And this is not to say that algorithmic decision making is always something that you should be using in these types of applications, but I'm just trying to point out a few places where people are starting to use algorithms to make decisions that perhaps you wouldn't have thought they were being used. And then of course, there's things like if you use social media, the content that you're exposed to and what you see is determined by that private company's algorithm. We don't have a lot of insight into exactly how those things work, but they end up determining a lot of our experience online, who we connect with, what sort of content we're exposed to, what viewpoints we're exposed to. So all of these are just a sample, I guess, of the various algorithms that are starting to control different aspects of our lives.
You were using both algorithm and model and all of these things. How should we think about these words?
Yeah, I perhaps it should be a little bit more careful with how I use them. In general, I'm using algorithm or model or algorithmic decision-making system basically to describe a computerized system by which some inputs about you, some attributes about you are fed into that system. And what comes out of it is a decision or a recommendation or a set of content for you to view. Basically, some decision is made on your behalf or about you based on those attributes that the computer sees. And there are various ways you can build these types of models. We can get into that more if that's useful, but that's sort of a general framework for the way that I think about it.
It is a little, no, I'm not going to go in that direction. Maybe I'll go in that direction later. So many things. How should someone think about how this model, a model is being used? Because you were giving lots of examples that I think are really, you know, bringing to fore that these are everywhere right now. We kind of don't know exactly when we got here, but now suddenly, you know, here they are. So how should we think about how such a model is being created?
In general, these models are being created by data from the past, right? Other people's behavior, other people's actions from the past are then used to find patterns, right? Basically, the model building process is a process by which you look at historical data, identify patterns, and then seek to replicate those patterns going forwards, right? So for instance, if we're talking about like an algorithm on Twitter feed or something like that, right? How does Twitter decide what you want to see? The way they do it is they look at people's behaviors from the past. What did people interact with? What did people seem to engage with? And they use that to try to identify the content that is most engaging, that is perhaps most likely to get you to interact with it. And then they try to show you that content. And they can continuously update these models over time as they observe people's behaviors. They can try out different things and experiment. In general, they have to have some sort of concrete objective that they're looking for, right? What is the algorithm actually, or the model, or whatever we're going to call it, what is it actually trying to optimize for? In a lot of these social media applications, it's trying to optimize for engagement, like likes, clicks, retweets, whatever. This is obviously very dependent on the application though, because in a setting like the, let's say, credit decisions that we were talking about in the past, the objective that they're trying to optimize is something like, are you going to repay this loan? Or are you going to be able to pay for your expenses on this credit card? So in general, what they do is they say, here's the thing that we are trying to optimize. Here's the objective, as they call it. And then they look at past data and try to essentially correlate patterns in that past data to the outcome or objective that they're trying to predict, and then sort of reinforce those patterns going forward.
How did you become interested in studying some of these societal impacts?
That's a good question. I don't know if it was any one particular moment for me. I have to say, I was very fortunate in grad school that my advisor, John Kleinberg, was super flexible on what I was allowed to work on and also the things that he was interested in. I think out of several conversations we had, I started to realize that the theory is interesting to me. And theoretical computer science is always going to be something I'm generally interested in. But what I really wanted to do was to be able to use that theory to, in a sense, tell stories about the world or understand the world better. And so to me, this seemed like the right way to apply the skills that I developed to an application, I guess, that I found compelling and that I'm passionate about. So it's hard to say that, again, I don't think there's any one moment when it really hit me that this is what I wanted to do. It was more of having studied on the theoretical side of things, I started to try out a little bit more and more trying to apply those ideas to how we think about society. And the more I did it, the more I realized that this is what I wanted to continue doing.
Some of the considerations that you're particularly looking into are the legal, economic, and normative considerations. Mm-hmm. How exactly do these perspectives come together in your research?
Yeah, so in a sense, you can look at all the various ways that people are applying algorithmic decision-making throughout society. And you might intuitively say, oh, I don't like this. I like what they're doing here. But it's ultimately, there's some need for a principled way of looking at the use of algorithmic decision-making and saying, here's how we should think about this. Here are the ways in which we should use it. And here's how it shouldn't be used. And that word should is difficult for computer scientists in general, right? Because the way that we're trained is to think about what you can and can't do, right? What is possible and what is not. And that's often very different from what you should and should not do. And so when I say normative, I guess that word should is a normative word. What should you do? Now, how do we actually determine what we should do? Well, people will, first of all, reasonably disagree about what we should do. But at the very least, what we can try to do is come up with frameworks for taking the way that other people have thought about normative decision-making in the past and try to apply it to algorithmic decision making. So for instance, the law thinks a lot about what we should and shouldn't do, right? We have protections against various types of actions. For instance, all of discrimination law is basically trying to make the point, yes, you can do this, but you should not, right? You can discriminate, but according to the law, you should not. And as a society, that's what we want to see. And similarly, economics and normative economics has ways of thinking about, if we have a scarce resource, how should it be allocated, right? How should we prioritize various people's welfare? Again, there's going to be disagreement on what the answer to that question is, but these disciplines at least give us principled frameworks with which we can express that disagreement. So trying to leverage those frameworks and bring them into algorithmic decision-making and generally the computational way of thinking is, I think, a valuable goal and one that we're hoping will be pursued over the next several years.
How have these helped you kind of understand more about how people work? You were saying that that's something that seems to motivate you. How exactly are these working vis-a-vis, you know, algorithms and how they're being used?
Perhaps the thing that I've studied maybe the most is the application of discrimination law to algorithmic decision-making. So discrimination law in certain contexts prevents certain actions, right? So, and it's usually specific, at least in the United States, it's specific to a particular domain. So for instance, with respect to employment, we have certain laws that prevent discrimination. With respect to housing, we again have certain laws that prevent discrimination. So let's take employment as an example, right? Discrimination law is written to prevent people from making discriminatory hiring decisions, say, mm-hmm. right? That is one particular application of employment discrimination law. Now you could ask the question, we sort of know how this applies when humans are making those decisions, right? What we know a little bit less about is, how should I think about discrimination law when 1,000 people apply to a country or to a company and a resume screener selects 300 of them to move on to the next interview stage, right? Now, there were some human decision-making that went into the process by which that resume screener was constructed, but each individual decision now is just automated in some way. And so there's not a direct mapping from the existing legal protections we have onto what this resume screener is doing, mm-hmm. right? And this is the type of thing that people encounter all the time, right? You just cold apply to a big company, chances are you're going through some HR system. It's going to have some resume screening function attached to it. So these algorithms are actually quite prevalent, or these models, whatever we want to call them,
sure.
quite prevalent, but it's not entirely clear what it would mean for them to be discriminatory or non-discriminatory. And so part of what we're trying to figure out now is, first of all, one, how can existing laws apply to these new tools? And two, do we need new legislation to govern their behavior or govern their use and construction? So this is just one of the ways where I think we struggled over, you know, decades and centuries to figure out how should we constrain people's behavior in order to, you know, promote positive societal outcomes, including non-discrimination. And those same constraints may not necessarily apply or have the effects that we want when we try to just directly apply them to the models or algorithms that we're building now. So that, I think, is one of the big challenges that we face now. And in some sense, I try to look at it as also an opportunity to perhaps update and strengthen the protections that we have now, given that these decisions are being standardized in some sense by algorithmic decision-making and propagated throughout society.
So you were saying that sometimes it's hard to see exactly if the way the algorithm, or like the results, right, are problematic. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's very obvious that the results are problematic. I recently watched Coding Bias. For listeners who haven't seen or heard of it, it's a documentary on biases and using AI for facial recognition. It seems that you've seen it.
I haven't watched the full documentary yet, but I've seen excerpts from it and read papers by the people featured in the documentary.
There we go, right? The theory behind what had happened. In that instance, right, it's very obvious that something went wrong. So I guess it seems that there's a spectrum in catching up, like running behind the algorithms a little bit, between like, oh, it's used here and here it might be okay, we don't know, versus it's used here it's definitely not okay, we do know. How do we navigate all of this? Like, do you think we should prioritize certain problems? Do you think some problems are easier than others? Or
Okay, these are good questions. So you're right in that there's a spectrum. There's several dimensions along which these applications can differ. There's, so you point out, there are some cases where things seem obviously problematic, like the cases explored in coded bias. And I would contrast that with cases where there will actually be a lot of disagreement in what is considered problematic. And a lot of this disagreement can be correlated to people's, you know, political views or sort of normatively how they want society to be. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, people will reasonably disagree about what they consider problematic and what they don't. So that is sort of one axis along which problems can be easier or harder. Now, that's somewhat related to, but still distinct from, the axis of, is this prohibited by any sort of legislation, right? Because mm-hmm. there are things that we might think are problematic that are still legal, and there are things that are illegal that we might think are actually not that problematic, right? So mm-hmm. the law doesn't completely map to our intuitive sense of right and wrong. For instance, in the case of people selling facial recognition technology that is not as accurate for darker faces than it is for lighter faces, which is one of the biases explored in Coded Bias, we can perhaps all agree that this is normatively problematic in some sense. In the applications in which they were being used, it actually wasn't clear that that was illegal, right? Some private company released a tool. Sure, we can say that we wish that they had either not released that tool in the first place or made it accurate and work for everybody. You know, there's different ways you could try to fix this. But the point is, the law actually doesn't prohibit them from selling a biased tool in that sense, mm-hmm. right? So our sense of right and wrong, again, is distinct from what people are actually allowed to do or not by the law. And then there's another axis, which I think is perhaps technical difficulty, I think what you were alluding to there. Some problems are easier to solve than others in some sense. Like if your solution to this problem of biased facial recognition, if what you really want is to make this facial recognition software work well for everybody, for people of all skin tones, the solution to that, I mean, from a technical perspective, it's not particularly challenging. Perhaps from an implementation standpoint, it is. The solution is collect more data on people for whom the accuracy is not currently very good. That's the solution that many of these companies actually tried to employ in response to all the controversy that came out over this, where basically they were like, okay, we'll just collect more data from people with darker skin tones and we'll make, in general, I think the rule to think about is the more data you have about some population, the more accurate models you'll be able to build for that population, right? So they made the point, okay, we haven't collected enough data on these darker skin populations. We'll do that. And now the tool will be more accurate, right? And so in that sense, that's their solution to the problem of bias in this application. Now, I'll contrast that to cases where, for instance, there may be hard trade-offs between different normative goals that people have, let's say. I think the one that you'll most commonly hear, and we can talk about how real this problem seems in practice, but the one that you'll most commonly hear is, look, we can either build models that are very accurate, or we can build models that are in some sense fair with respect to groups of people that they're evaluating, right? That they don't produce vastly different outcomes for different groups of people, but we can't do both. That's the common refrain that you might hear, that there's some trade-off between being accurate and being fair. I mean, and this is not a trade-off that is unique to algorithmic decision-making. You often hear this in the context of debates over affirmative action, for instance, where people will say, well, if we don't admit the people with the highest test scores, then in some sense, we're being unfair to the people who had high test scores, but still didn't get into Harvard or whatever, right? So this conception of a trade-off between accuracy or utility of the tool and being fair to different people involved, I think is one that you'll hear often. In practice, it's actually not clear that that is a hard trade-off. We can talk a little bit about the research that seems to point to that. But I think fundamentally, I'd class that, going back to the conversation we were having about technical difficulty, understanding those trade-offs, determining if they exist in a particular application and figuring out how to resolve those trade-offs, I see as somewhat challenging, both from a technical perspective and also from a normative perspective of, we may disagree on what the right way to resolve those trade-offs is, as opposed to something like, if your goal is to make a tool that is equally accurate for everyone or competently accurate for everyone, we can all agree that, okay, the right thing you should do is collect data from everyone, right? That is obvious technical solution to that problem. So I guess that's the third axis that I'll come back to, is perhaps the difficulty of technical solution, as well as the degree to which that solution is going to require us to agree normatively on how we resolve trade-offs.
I do want to talk a little bit more about fairness, because I feel like it's this word that keeps popping up whenever there's anything related to artificial intelligence or machine learning. I feel like it just comes along. Mm-hmm. And when you were talking about things, it seems another one of those terms where what I intuitively mean by fairness may not necessarily be the like way we technically define what fairness can be.
Yeah, it's an overloaded term. And I think it's sort of unfortunate, and I'm guilty of this too, of using the word fairness in a technical context, because any way that you seek, like, because people have different conceptions of what fairness means, now trying to pin that down to a single technical definition or even a group of technical definitions overloads the term. It means too many different things simultaneously, right? So I think the solution that hopefully the community is moving to is to be more specific what we mean when we say things like, instead of saying fairness in a technical context, just say what you mean, right? Say the actual technical definition that you're talking about. And actually, this can have some negative consequences in practice, actually, where let's say you're somebody who's building an algorithm, right? And you have some particular technical definition of what you consider to be fairness, and you make sure that tool satisfies that technical definition. Now you can claim that you have a fair tool. And the word fair, when you say it out loud, comes with all the sort of normative connotations of, you know, this is positive for society in some way, when what you really mean is that you satisfied some narrow technical definition.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It can be used intentionally in misleading ways, which sort of bothers me. But to your question of what do we mean by fairness in a technical context, and how do we operationalize a normative construct like fairness that we have in the real world? I think the answer is, to some extent, you don't. You can't just take something that, you can't take something that's complex and multidimensional, like the concept of fairness, and turn it into a mathematical equation. I think the best you can really hope for, actually, I think there's a few ways that you can still make some positive contribution towards this concept of fairness without trying to rely too heavily on mathematical definitions to get you there. One way of doing this is, I think that to some extent, it requires a shift in perspective where, as computer scientists, you're trained to say, you tell me what you want, and I will figure out the optimal way of doing it, right? You tell me what your objective is, and I'll tell you how to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And in that framework, in that way of thinking, the way you view fairness is in some sense a constraint on what you do, right? You're saying, okay, you want this tool, you want it to be accurate, but you also want it to be fair. So what I'll do is I'll say, okay, tell me what you mean technically by fairness. Turn that into like a mathematical constraint. And then I'll figure out how to get you the most accurate outcome possible, subject to that constraint of fairness that you gave me.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of the default or most natural way of thinking for a computer scientist. And I think the shift in perspective that you need is something like the following. You'll never actually be able to tell me exactly what you mean by fairness, right? You'll never actually be able to mathematically specify that. What you might be able to do, though, is mathematically specify things that you definitely don't want to see, right? You might be able to say, okay, if I observe this particular outcome or this set of outcomes, something has to be wrong, or this that is unacceptable in some way. From that perspective, these mathematical operationalizations serve as something as a diagnostic tool where you can say, okay, let me take a look at this data and I can run some diagnostic tests on it, right? I can look through some mathematical formulations. If I detect that something has gone wrong, I should probably go fix that. But the absence of a violation of one of those mathematical tests I was looking at, just because it doesn't violate one of them, it doesn't mean that it's certified as fair in some way. It just means that I didn't detect the particular problems that I happened to be looking for, right? And I think viewing it as it's not going to tell us the right answer, but it might help us eliminate some of the wrong answers, I think is a one positive shift in the way that we might think about these tools. The other way I think it's useful is these being able to formalize things gives us a language with which we can discuss and perhaps argue about the different objectives and different constraints that we might want, right? We might be able to, it's a little hard to reason formally about what is fair and what is not fair and where we actually disagree until we actually have the language to do that. So I view some of these mathematical conceptions of fairness, if you will, I hesitate to keep using that word, but we can look at some of these mathematical formulations as giving us the language to disagree or giving us the language to reason about trade-offs. Ultimately, I think one answer is it's not really up to computer scientists, the normative question about how should we build these tools, but what we might be able to do is they may be hard for legislators or policymakers to reason about models and individual models and say this one is better than that one. But it might be a little bit easier for them to reason about abstract higher level properties and say, I prefer this property than that property. I prefer this way of looking at the world over that way of looking at the world. And the computer scientists have to do the work of translating those properties, those high level abstract ideas, into perhaps the technical formulations, but at least expose enough of the differences between them and their actual impact on the world to let somebody else make that decision. So I think providing language is another way that we might be of some help to the world.
Yeah, I think so much of it is just like, sometimes I think of even math as like learning a new language, and same thing with like, you know, computer science literally is like learning a new language. So that kind of just like keeps going as you move along. So many questions still. I guess I'll switch gears a little bit, but you've just graduated with your PhD in computer science from Cornell. Congratulations.
Thank you.
You will be a postdoc at Harvard this coming year. Congratulations. And then you'll be assistant professor at MIT the next year. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, it's all very exciting. I'm looking forward to it.
Logistically first, I guess, before the end question that we're working towards, I guess, is like, what are the kinds of questions that you're looking forward to like looking into and answering? But I think logistically, like, how did that work? How did the application process deferring and negotiating and all of that work?
I simultaneously applied for faculty positions and postdoc positions. And when I got an offer to go to MIT, I asked them if I could take a year and do a postdoc, and they said yes. So it actually, they were very accommodating about it. And they basically said, if it's good for you, it's good for us. So
that's lovely. Did you have both offers when you were doing that? Or did you just think, no, I just need some time off, hopefully a postdoc, hopefully something else?
So I had both offers. And I think this might be somewhat common, but when I got the postdoc offer, I basically told them I would love to come as long as I'm allowed to defer for a year. And they said, sure, that's fine. Just let us know when you get that permission for a deferral. It hopefully won't be an issue. So yeah, everyone was very accommodating and basically said, whatever is best for you, you should try to do.
That's awesome. We need more happy stories. So what are the kinds of questions that you'll be working on at Harvard? And what are maybe longer term goals, the things that you're hoping to do at MIT?
So at Harvard, I'll be working with Cynthia Dwork at the Center for Research on Computation and Society, is I believe what the CRCS acronym stands for. And it's a really cool lab and group where basically the goal of the center is just to do exactly what I want to do, which is figure out how computation is going to impact society. So having just started 4 days ago, I don't have the full sense of exactly what I'm going to be working on, but my hope is to do something. I guess I should say in my PhD, I was a little bit more theory heavy still. And I think there's an opportunity at Harvard over the next year to get a little bit more embedded in particular applications and do a little bit more data-driven work and, you know, look at actual uses of algorithmic decision-making and be a little bit more, I guess, be able to say something at a little bit of a lower level about impacts on society. So that's the goal over the next, I guess, the short-term goal. The long-term goal at MIT, the position that I'll be in is split 50-50 between the business school, Sloan Management School, and the electrical engineering and computer science department there. So the balance to walk, I guess, is my hope is to be advising students from both the business school and from the computer science department, and also be teaching in both of those departments. So trying to figure out what the right intersection of topics is that'll be appealing to students in both of those groups. And I think basically the overlap between them in some sense, a large chunk of that overlap is in fact looking at how algorithmic decision-making impacts society, right? Both from maybe perhaps business applications and also public sector law and policy type applications. So my hope for the, you know, mid to long-term future is to be able to tap into all of the expertise and knowledge at MIT and also with collaborators around the world and really try to figure out, perhaps from a more policy perspective, how we should think about algorithms being used both by the government and by private actors, and try to understand what is the right way to constrain their behavior, to figure out when they should and should not be used. And the reason I think this is really important now is you're seeing a lot of debate at the government, at various levels of government, not just the United States, this is happening around the world. You're seeing a lot of debate on how algorithms should work and should be allowed to work. For instance, you see a lot of this when it comes to big tech companies. People are talking about regulating their algorithms in some way. But you also see it in perhaps criminal justice reform, where people are trying to understand, should we actually be using risk assessment algorithms in practice? And there's a lot of debate around that topic. Now, there's been bills in various states in the US. It feels like there's a lot of different domains in which we're reasoning about kind of the same questions, which are when and how should these things be used? Mm-hmm. I see the opportunity there to contribute to that debate and really help people fully understand what the choices that we have are and what their impacts might be. Mm-hmm. So that's, I guess, a broad framing of the goal of the near to long term, mid to long term future, maybe. But yeah, it's something that I'm super excited about. And again, I really see a huge opportunity, especially for students who want to start working in this area and to really have impact on society. I think this is a great opportunity.
So for someone who might be interested in even something that seems a little more specific, right? Societal impacts of algorithmic decision-making. You're saying there's still quite a broad range of things that you might do. You might be doing things that are more theory heavy. You might be doing things that have more data. So let's maybe go into a little more detail. What does a project look like? Like, what does a research question answer process look like?
Good question. Okay, so it often depends on who I'm working with and what their style is. Mm-hmm. I've been really fortunate to get to learn from a bunch of very different, but all very fantastic mentors. You know, people with law backgrounds, people with computer science backgrounds, people with business backgrounds, right? Really all over the map, actually. Let me give you a sense for at least what it's been like for most of my work, which is with my advisor, John Kleinberg. A lot of what we do is think about the inception of many of these projects starts from, what do people disagree about? And for those things that people disagree about, what would help form a at least more structured debate or be able to take a position? Like, what information would you need to know more about that debate and to be able mm-hmm. to weigh in on the debate? And starting from a question like that, I'll give you an example of one of the first things I got to work on, actually. There was an article that was written in the summer of 2016 about a risk assessment algorithm used in the criminal justice system. The article was making the claim that the model or algorithm that was being used was biased against African-American defendants. And what this model was trying to do was predict recidivism. So if somebody shows up for a pretrial hearing, these models would be used to predict essentially whether this person was likely to commit a crime in the next 2 years. Mm-hmm. And they would use this as one of the factors that a judge would consider when deciding whether to let this person out on bail or not. What the article found was basically that African-American defendants were being falsely labeled high risk at about twice the rate of white defendants. Mm-hmm. And so they look at this and they said, this is evidence that this algorithm is clearly biased against African-American defendants. And it was pretty compelling. It seemed like, yes, that evidence is hard to ignore. And it seemed like that was that. But then the company that actually built the algorithm, built the model, responded, and they put out this big tens of pages of technical report saying, here are all the statistical tests we run to look for racial bias, and it passes all of our tests, right? And so now you have an instance where there's a debate going on, right? These people are saying the algorithm is biased. Some other people are saying it's not. Both sides are providing quantitative evidence, which is somewhat unusual in debates that you see. And just looking at that evidence, it's not actually clear what you should believe, right? If you take the position that risk assessment algorithms should not be used at all in the criminal justice system, then perhaps it's
moot point.
Which is a valid position to take.
Right.
So from that perspective, sure, it's clear what your opinion should be. But if that's not the perspective you take, then it's not clear, right? Then you look at this evidence and you say, I actually don't know if I should think this thing is good or bad or what's wrong with it. And so that was the start of a project of just trying to understand, what are these quantitative claims, or how can we really rigorously formalize the claims that these different parties are making and compare them to one another and understand, how can these things all simultaneously be true in some sense? And basically the answer was that it was actually impossible to make everyone happy. And mm-hmm. what I mean by that is, in a world where there's already some amount of bias or disparities between different racial groups, which is the world that we live in that world, it's impossible to constrain a model to hide that bias completely, right? That those discrepancies are going to manifest somewhere. You can't just paper them over by running them through a model, right? Mm-hmm. So basically the answer was, look, if there are disparities in the world, there's going to be disparities in whatever the model does. You'll always be able to find those disparities somehow. So if you're the company that built the algorithm, you said, well, it satisfies the test that we ran. And if you're ProPublica, which was the news outlet that had discovered some disparities, what they said was, well, you didn't run these tests, and these tests show that there are differences between groups. And the answer was, well, those differences had to show up somewhere. Right? Mm-hmm. Now, there's a separate question of, if you are in a world where you say, I actually do want to use risk assessment algorithms in the criminal justice system, then there's a question of, how do you resolve that trade-off, right? If we know that there are going to be disparities somewhere, in a sense, where should we put those disparities, right? What's the right way to do it? And again, that can be an ongoing debate. And I see that debate is somewhat outside the scope. Like, it's not really my job to normatively answer the question, how should we resolve these trade-offs? Hopefully, the best that we can do is to say, is to make it very clear what the possible options are, such that legislators, people who have the sort of democratic authority to make these decisions, are able to fully understand the issues at play and make some decisions. So that's one, I guess that's a glimpse of what a project could mm-hmm. look like. But it starts with basically, what do we not understand about the world, or what do we not understand about people's disagreements, specifically as they pertain to algorithmic decision making? And how might we formally explore that disagreement and try to better understand it?
Mm-hmm. I really like that. It seems both hopeful and hopeless that, like, if there are problems in the world, they're just gonna come up in the algorithm. So you just have to, like, you can't be like, oh no, I designed this and this is great. You have to be like, well, if it is great, then something somewhere went wrong. Mm-hmm. So.
Right. If things look perfect, then I think the answer is you just haven't looked hard enough.
Right. You're part of the Bias, Discrimination, and Fairness Working Group within the Mechanism Design for Social Group Initiative. By the time this episode with you will air, we will have aired the episode where I chat with Wenyi Dai Li, who introduces this initiative a little bit in her involvement. What I like about this is kind of the growth. It was created, I think, in 2016 by Redia Abebe and Kara Goldner, and it was 12 members, and now it's like 2,000. And the working group that you're part of has quite a lot of people. Have you been part of this for a while? How has that growth manifested in terms of, like, collaboration, advocating for certain issues, stuff like that?
Yeah, so I met Redia and Kira at a conference in 2016, I think. And right around this time, I think they were having conversations somewhat to the effect of, mechanism design as a field is predominantly geared towards profit maximization, right? Mm. Like a huge component of the field is optimal auctions and optimal mechanisms from the perspective of the person who makes money from it, right? And I think the questions that they wanted to ask were more along the lines of, how can we design mechanisms that are good for people, right? That actually benefit the participant. And I think there's a lot of, I shouldn't mischaracterize the field. There's a lot of work on, for instance, mechanisms for school choice, which are used to try to match students to the schools that they most want to go to and do that sort of allocation. Now, you can disagree with the various implementations across the country, but the field, I guess I should say, is not entirely about profit maximization. But so they were having those conversations way back then. And I think I probably joined Mechanism Design for Social Good sometime in 2016 or 2017. At the time, yeah, it was just a small group of us, and we would meet every couple of weeks. It was all virtual. So much before COVID, we were doing everything remotely because there were people from all across the world participating in these meetings. It actually became one of the challenges, was just the time zone differences, right? Because if people all the way around the world, when are you going to find a meeting time that isn't the middle of the night for someone? But at the time, it was, you know, we'd have speakers come in and talk about their work. And then Reddit, Kira, and Irene Lowe as well were started organizing some workshops, and they would take place at these annual conferences. And from there, it really just took off. I think it tapped into an interest that a lot of people had and didn't have an outlet for in academia, which was for people who still want to do their work in academia, but also have some positive impact and perhaps think about questions which might lead to some positive societal impact. Of course, that's always been a possibility in academia. I think it just was the supply wasn't high enough. There was more demand than supply is maybe the right way to characterize it. And I think people didn't realize that. Maybe one thing to take away from the sort of explosive growth that MD4SG has had, apart from, you know, the enormous amounts of effort that the organizers have put in, is that there's just so many people who want this to be a part of their lives and who want to participate in this way. So to me, that's been super encouraging. In recent years, it's gotten so big that we can't just have one bi-weekly meeting where everyone shows up. So it's sort of been broken up by interest group. So I, at some point a couple of years ago, I was running this bias, fairness, discrimination working group. And again, we'd have speakers come in every couple of weeks. People would talk about research. And then from there, it's expanded to the point where we were able to do entire research projects remotely with people that perhaps we never even met in person. Like we wrote a paper on, ideas of fairness and non-discrimination through, some combination of the machine learning and mechanism design world. I haven't met some of the authors in person. I've only seen them on a screen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been fantastic. I feel like I know them fairly well because I've, been in contact with them once every week or two over the course of years, but somehow just have never seen them in person. So yeah, it's been, I think, a really positive vehicle for people to get involved and meet each other. The organization and the organizers, I think, do a very good job of outreach as well and try hard to bring in people who may not have thought to join in the first place or, may not know anybody in the group, but still are encouraged to participate. So yeah, overall, I think it's been quite a positive initiative, definitely one that's positively impacted me, and I hope others throughout the world. And yeah, I have to say that it's not really a question of luck. It's just the organizers have put in a ton of work in making this happen. And I think the entire community is very grateful to them for that.
Mm-hmm. I want to kind of end by switching gears and talk about soccer. You played soccer for Cornell in the club soccer team.
Yes.
You were the only grad student in the roster, is that right?
Towards the end, I think we might have had a master's student at some point during my time there. We might have had an MBA student or two, but at least I hadn't really encountered other PhD students on my team, yeah.
Right. What was that like? How long have you been playing soccer for?
Over 20 years now. It's been fantastic. So I played club soccer through college, and then when I got to grad school, I figured I had to keep going somehow. Mm-hmm. It's actually, I think the concern that people often have, and definitely the one that I had when I first started playing, was that I just wouldn't have time to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, because I've been playing soccer my whole life, I think the way it works for me is actually it helps me organize my time, where if I know that I have training 5 to 7 p.m., I know I'm not going to get any work done after that because I'm going to be exhausted. So now that I know I have that hard time limit, it forces me to organize my time a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
And work within those constraints. So in that sense, I think it's actually been really good for me. And it's given me the opportunity to travel a lot. I've been to, there's a club national competition. I've probably been 5 times now, combining college and in grad school. And you'll go to Alabama for 5 days and just play soccer every day, or Tennessee or Phoenix or something like that. It's a really unique experience, actually. And you go with a group of 20 people who you know them really well, you've been working hard with them all year, and gives you the opportunity to compete. And that's something I've always really valued.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you'll try to keep going, keep playing?
Yeah, I think as you get older, it's harder to, physically it's harder for you. It's, for me, it's also harder to find people who want to play and are willing to commit at the same level. So having just moved to Cambridge, Massachusetts, I'm sure there's people here. I found a few teams to play in. So trying to keep it up a little bit, and we'll see where it goes.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Manish, thank you so much. This has been so much fun. I loved our conversation.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking the time. I appreciate it.
This was such a wonderful chat, and I'm delighted to finally be able to share it. Even though it was recorded a very long time ago, it feels like a timeless classic, as these topics are still relevant, perhaps even more so. So many things stood out to me, but the thing I'd like to end this episode on is related to Manish's comment on the importance of having good mentors. They're hard to find, but they can really help you flourish. Wherever you are in your career, I encourage you to think about, what does good mentorship look like for you? What have your mentors taught you to do? Or maybe not to do? And how can we move forward in the world, supporting the ones around us to reach their best potential? We're in this together. Our music is Float and Fly by Golgartelli. This episode was edited by Noah Lloyd. Thanks for listening. I will talk to you again soon.